This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. The president's proposed 2020 budget has been sent to Congress, and with it, no surprises.
Now, President Donald Trump's $4.7 trillion budget proposal calls for cuts to Medicare and Medicaid.
Food stamps would be cut by a third. The EPA budget would be cut by nearly one third. And funding for UNICEF, among other programs, would be eliminated.
All in all, a full-on assault on the most vulnerable Americans, couched in the language of moral superiority. The rhetoric is hardly an invention of Trump world. It also guided the thinking of Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton, whose center-left triangulation politics yielded strangulation policies, especially for the urban poor. But that was then, and this is now. In 2019, Trumpism is faced with a stark counter-narrative. The Democratic sweep of the House of Representatives and the crowded field of presidential candidates have put some policies on the table that even a few years ago lived only in the nightmares of right-wing Cassandras. Medicare for all, Green New Deal, and now, believe it or not, universal basic income.
The freedom dividend. Simply put, every American adult gets $1,000 a month, free and clear, no questions asked, to do whatever you want.
UBI, also known as free money, the explicit expansion of the welfare state based not on Marxist theory, but on data, experimentation, and economic reason. And you may well recognize one of its biggest proponents because he's not only a journalist, author, and economic philosopher, he's a meme.
And you're all like, oh, I'm against the globalist elite, blah, blah, blah. It's not very convincing, to be honest.
Why don't you go f*** yourself, you tiny brain, and I hope this gets picked up, because you're a moron. I tried to give you a hearing, but you were too annoying for me.
You can't handle the criticism, can you?
Yes, that's the confrontation between Fox News host Tucker Carlson and Rutger Bregman, author of Utopia for Realists. Carlson invited Bregman for having had the audacity to call out World Economic Forum billionaires in Davos for the hypocrisy of their liberal rhetoric. But the little Tucker got a little more than he bargained for, and we all got introduced to a loud proponent of universal basic income. Rutger, welcome to the Not Tucker Carlson Show.
It's great to be here.
Okay, you're not new to the utopia space. Mm-hmm. Your book was published in 2014, but you were kind of under the radar here until Davos.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
During the conference, I became more and more uncomfortable with the idea of just promoting my book and not saying something about the extraordinary hypocrisy of the whole conference, because everyone's talking about all sorts of wonderful ideas like feminism and participation, equality, but no one was talking about taxes.
From your perspective, they were avoiding the central problem of global society.
Exactly. And I got so much pushback when I started raising the idea of higher taxes, that we should do something about tax avoidance. These people often use philanthropy as a way to distract people from the real issues, right? They have all these wonderful plans about, oh, I'm doing something with girls' education in Uganda. And I'm not against that, but pay your taxes first, please.
And you're speaking of progressive taxes with very high marginal tax rates, what conservatives, and I guess your audience at Davos, would call confiscatory taxes.
Yes, exactly. Just as we had in the 50s. So under Republican President Eisenhower, for example, the top marginal tax rate in this country for billionaires was 90%. The estate tax was over 70%. This was the case around the developed world. It's only since the 70s and the 80s that tax rates have gone down and down and down, and inequality has grown and grown and grown. So it's really about going back to an older tradition.
Now, Rutger, if you did not exist, conservatives would have to invent you, because your proposals represent the very nanny state, big government, welfare queen nourishing society that they have been screaming about for 50 years. Government handouts, open borders, 15-hour work week, and, you know, probably trees overflowing with gumdrops. Now, your book lays this all out very succinctly, but would you please explain why you are not, in addition to a bogeyman for the right, an actual commie lunatic?
I really think that the idea of a universal basic income is the perfect marriage between progressive and conservative thinking, between the left and the right. So what the left gets is obviously the eradication of poverty, a pretty good thing in itself. Now, what the right gets is a much smaller state in terms of paternalism. The traditional left always wants to help people to make better decisions, right? To put them in all these kind of programs. My idea is that poverty is not a lack of character, but just a lack of cash. And if you just give people the means to make their own choices, give them the freedom, then they'll have some venture capital and they can move on to a different job, start a new company, move to a different city, which will unleash a lot of dynamism and energy in the economy. So actually, I think that a universal basic income would be the crowning achievement of capitalism.
And the evidence suggests, you write, that, you know, contrary to the axiom that rather than giving someone fish, it's better to teach them to fish, you're saying, no, give them the fish. In fact, give them the cash and let them buy their own damn fish.
Yeah. There have been fascinating experiments in the 70s in this country where, you know, thousands of families received a guaranteed basic income. And the researchers just track what happened and try to find out whether, you know, people use this money in a good way, whether they stop working. And time again, what the scientists have found is that healthcare costs go down, crime goes down, kids do much better in school. And this is really an investment that pays for itself. There's a wonderful study that's been going on in North Carolina for years now, since the early 90s, where there's the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians that started operating a casino there. And they give out all the earnings of the casino to the members of the band, which has pulled a lot of people out of poverty. And what researchers have found out is that actually the reductions in terms of lower healthcare costs, lower crime rates, are bigger than the cash grants themselves. So in that sense, this is literally free money. It's an investment that pays for itself.
You're not all alone in discussing this.
We should explore ideas like universal basic income to make sure that everyone has a cushion to try new ideas.
And I think ultimately we will have to have some kind of universal basic income.
Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang, and others have raised the notion of universal basic income. Mm-hmm. And there's this kind of jaw-dropping fact that there was another big booster of free money. Mm-hmm. And that was...
The present welfare system has to be judged a colossal failure.
Richard Nixon. Yeah.
Tell me.
So you have to know that at the end of the 60s, almost all the experts believed that some form of guaranteed basic income was going to be implemented. It was a hugely popular idea back in the day. So in the early 70s, Nixon thought, okay, well, if everyone is in favor of this, you know what? I'll be the president that implements it.
And that is why tonight I therefore propose that we abolish the present welfare system and that we adopt in its place a new family assistance system.
So he had a bill for a modest basic income that went through the House of Representatives twice.
For a family of four now on welfare with no outside income, the basic federal payment would be $1,600 a year.
And was only killed in the Senate by Democrats, actually, not because they didn't like the idea of a basic income for everyone, but because they wanted a higher basic income. So it's a terrible, terrible irony that it didn't happen back then.
It's just hard for me to get my head around the idea that it was that close. Now, by the time it failed in the Senate, Nixon himself had already been sort of moved off of the idea because he had learned a historical argument against universal basic income, I think from 19th century England.
So what happened in the early 19th century is that there was a small program called the Spenhamlet system where certain British towns tried to do something about poverty. It was sort of the first basic income-ish program. And back then in 1834, there was a report written by the English government where researchers were very, very critical of this program. You know, they wrote thousands of pages how this basic income had made the poor too dependent, too lazy. Marriages had broken down and, you know, that it was basically a total disaster. Now, fast forward 150 years, Nixon is thinking about, do I want to implement this basic income? And am I enthusiastic about that? And then one of his advisors, a guy named Martin Anderson, who was a huge fan of people like Ayn Rand and Milton Friedman, he put forward that it had been a disaster back then. So that more or less convinced Nixon to change his rhetoric.
And for the first time, benefits would be scaled in such a way that it would always pay to work. With such incentives, most recipients who can work will want to work. This is part of the American character.
To, you know, talk about workfare instead of welfare and start talking about the lazy poor, etc. What he didn't know is that actually this whole report that was made in the 1830s by government so-called scientists was actually a hoax. That's what historians later found out in the 60s and the 70s, is that all of the evidence was just made up, basically, and that in reality, it was quite a successful program. It's a great example of how contingent history sometimes can be, and that it's not governed by big laws, but that sometimes small things can make a huge difference.
Just to be clear, you're not saying that people will live entirely on their universal basic income. No, the data suggests that once they have that, their instinct is not to work less, but to work more.
The basic income is really a floor on which you can always stand. You can always fall back on it. In all these experiments that happened around the globe since the 1970s, is that people sometimes do a little bit less paid work, like 3-4%. You see very small reductions. But this is always compensated by people doing more volunteers work, caring for their kids, caring for the elderly, or maybe start a new company or something like that.
All right. So once again, if we'd been having this conversation even, I don't know, 2 years ago, people would think that you and I had both taken leave of our senses.
Yeah.
But holy moly, maybe your time has come. Overton window seems to have cracked open a little bit.
Uh-huh.
What's changed to make these proposals even thinkable? Why are you all of a sudden not such a marginal figure?
Well, there's a great saying in science. Science progresses one funeral at a time. And I sometimes have the feeling that the same is true for politics. So I'm part of a generation that was born just before or after the fall of the Berlin Wall. We're not traumatized by the Cold War. We don't look at the world in terms of, oh, this is capitalism versus socialism. And like the standard responses that you always get is, oh, that sounds like communism, that sounds like Venezuela. That doesn't work anymore. We say whatever, because we see the huge challenges that lie ahead. Climate change, income inequality spiraling out of control. So I guess it's just really a new generation that is desperate for new ideas and doesn't only want to know what it's against, but also wants something to be actually for.
There was this moment in your confrontation with Tucker Carlson that he expressed incredulity that you were even familiar with Fox. And I think you told him that you have the internet in the Netherlands. It kind of makes me wonder how the partisan, increasingly polemical media world we're living in now affects this debate and affect your chances of actually seeing the kind of progress you want to see.
Well, I thought for a long time about whether I wanted to release this recording of the Tucker Carlson interview, yes or no. In the end, why I decided to do it was simply because it would ensure that we'd be talking about the right things for a couple of days, right? There would be a lot of oxygen going to talking about taxes and taxation and inequality. What I realized at that point is that releasing the video, yes or no, it's really a matter of, yeah, what's your deep philosophy of how political change works? You know, do you believe that people need to get together and have this constructive conversation? Or do you believe that sometimes you need to just aggressively put forward certain issues? And normally I would prefer the former, but I'm afraid we live in a world now that sometimes you just need to use the latter strategy.
Gigantic shifts, I would say tectonic shifts in economic policy and the role of government tend to happen over long periods of time after being battled out by think tanks in the media and lots of failed legislation and so on. But then there was, you know, same-sex marriage, which kind of came from nowhere to become the law of the land in just a few years.
Exactly.
Does the zeitgeist offer you an opportunity to affect change that otherwise would have been glacial in its evolution?
My take on history is that if you zoom out a little bit, you see that every milestone of civilization was once a utopian fantasy. So as Oscar Wilde once wrote at the end of the 19th century, progress is the realization of utopias. Democracy was once a crazy idea. The end of slavery was once dismissed as, oh, that's never going to happen. The welfare state was once seen as a bizarre, unreasonable idea. So I'm really interested in those people who are at the fringes of the debate and who are being dismissed. And then they start moving towards the center. But it works in both directions. If you look at the history of the 20th century, take the 50s, for example, what you see is that there was a small group of thinkers who called themselves neoliberals, like Milton Friedman and the Austrian philosopher Friedrich von Hayek. And they gathered in this place called Mont Pelerin in Switzerland. And they said to themselves, we're in the minority right now. I mean, we're the radicals. Everyone has become a socialist. Everyone believes in big government these days. But what we need to do is to start developing our ideas, building our networks, our think tanks, our institutions. And this will take years and years and years. But our moment will come. There will be a crisis in the future. And then we got to take the stage. And this is exactly what happened in the 70s. So if you want to know where Reagan and Thatcher came from, you got to go back to the 50s because they just got their ideas from people like Friedman and von Hayek. And that's what is happening right now. If you want to understand AOC, well, you got to do a good historical research into all the ideas that she's now advocating because it didn't come out of nowhere.
Rutger, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Journalist and economic historian Rutger Bregman is the author of Utopia for Realists, and Tucker Carlson doesn't like him.
Very true.
On a revolution, well, you know, we all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution, well, you know, we all want to change the world.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leia Feder, John Hanrahan, and Asa Chaturvedi. We had more help from Zandra Ellen, and our show was edited this week by our executive producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Bob Garfield. And hey, wanted to hear about the lost hate speech of Tucker Carlson that blew up this week? Check out the website, onthemedia.org.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.